Yes, thank you very much, Annalisa. Let me thank the organizers, first of all, for inviting me and for organizing this excellent conference. It's been very inspiring so far, and hopefully I can keep it that way. We heard about very complicated magnetic effects being actually simulated in the lab previously. I'm going to try to keep it a little more simple in terms of the morphology. And I'm going to try to give you an outline of the theory behind launching of jets. In particular, I will try to propose a model to launch jets with tangled magnetic fields as opposed to ordered magnetic fields that had been considered before. So here's an outline. I will briefly review the properties of jets as we know them and as they are observed, along with the questions that need to be addressed by jet models. Then I will go through a brief review of existing models and why we might want to extend them. Then I will try to outline the model that we made for tangled jets. And finally, if I have time, I will try to motivate why comparing jets at different mass scales might be an interesting tool to study jet physics as well as black holes. So jets are essentially collimated beams of plasma that propagate at very high speeds away from a central object. The central object could be a black hole in the case of an AGN, or a galactic black hole. It could be a neutron star, or even a young stellar object, or it could be a gamma ray burst. And so here I've shown three images of prototypical extragalactic jets. This is the M87 jet, which is, apart from Centaurus A, the closest by example, and it's best studied for that reason. This is Cygnus A, the prototypical radio galaxy. It's an FR2 source, this is an FR1 source. And this is 3C273, a powerful quasar, also one of the prototypical jet sources. So this is the radio image of Cygnus A, and you see that there is radio emission along the beam of this jet, and then there's relatively complex morphology here, a radio lobe that's inflated by the jet slamming into the environment. The radio emission that's emitted by the jet and in the lobes originates from the synchrotron emission process, which we can, which we know because of the polarization signature of the radiation. This image is actually optical. Unfortunately, somebody decided to turn that it should, on the sky, it should be turned by 45 degrees, but I guess it fits better on the image this way. So this is optical emission, and surprisingly, the optical emission in this jet is also synchrotron emission. And you see, in fact, from this image here that the emission is actually not very smooth. It's located in these knotty lumps that move out from the nucleus. This is X-ray emission, as seen by the Chandra Observatory. And you see that quite extensive X-ray emission is found in this jet over long scales, which imposes restrictions on the energetics of the underlying flow. So I mentioned before that jets are collimated. Typically, I guess the opening angle of these beams would be of the order of a few degrees, or it might even be smaller. And so any theory would have to explain how you can collimate a beam to such high degree. Also, at least in AGNs and in galactic binaries, and certainly in gamma ray bursts, the velocities that are inferred for the material moving in the jet are extremely high. These are ultra-relativistic velocities, and in AGN jets, and probably also in galactic jets, and in fact, Rob Fender just told me that they seem to have observed an object that might even be moving with a high velocity. Typically, from the observations of proper motions and beaming, one would infer that maybe the Lorentz vector would be of order 5 to 10. But in gamma bursts, it might even be up to 1,000. So these are order of magnitude estimates, because if you measure proper motions, you can never be sure that you're really actually measuring the bulk motion of the material. It might be that you're measuring pattern speeds instead. So I mentioned before, these jets can be found in AGNs and binaries and young stellar objects and in gamma bursts and everything, you know, it's like Sesame Street. What do these four things have in common? Well, they have accretion going on at the central object. And so there must be a connection, or at least it's plausible to assume that there's a connection between accretion and jet formation. They're powerful. In powerful FR2 radio galaxies, the kinetic luminosity of the jet can be a good fraction of the Eddington luminosity, let's say 10 to the 46 ergs, so it would be a powerful source indeed. And for gamma ray bursts, it might be as high as 10 to the 41 ergs per second for a very short amount of time, whereas in AGNs, of course, you would have this luminosity sustained over maybe 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 years. I mentioned before, it's not emission. Important thing is that you see the optical and X-ray emission to extend over very large length scales. And so that poses constraints on particle acceleration, which I will not go into much detail here. Also important to note is that at least in M87, which is a close-by source, you can resolve very close to the core using VLBI, and you find that the jet is collimated on a few hundred RG scales already, maybe 1,000 RG. And so whatever produces the jet must act relatively close to the core to already collimate the flow. So the questions that arise regarding jets that need to be answered by a model are the following. A, of course, what powers these flows? What accelerates them? What collimates them? In particular, this process needs to produce very high ultra-relativistic Lorentz factors. And the proposed or most successful, I guess, proposal would be the pointing flux of, say, a magnetic field threaded in the disk or the black hole, if you can tap the spin of the black hole. Alternatively, one might propose that you could drive the jet by radiation, and I will mention that briefly. Furthermore, we need to find out what the composition of the jet is. This is more an observational question than a theoretical question. It's still not known, actually, whether jets are composed of electron-positron plasma or if they're composed of electron-proton plasma. Various arguments have been made in favor of electron-positron plasma from either circular polarization measurements or various other power estimates. However, it's still not clear what the composition really is, because it really strongly depends on what you assume about the spectral shape at the low energies. Furthermore, this ties into the question of how you power these things. What's the magnetic field configuration in the jets? Is it poloidal? Is it toroidal? Is it tangled? I will go into that later. And finally, this is the question that I addressed earlier. How do you produce optical and X-ray emission over such large distances? This hints to possible processes that accelerate particles in situ. That is, you don't actually produce the relativistic particles that radiate in optical and X-rays in shocks and then let them cool. But instead, you might think of a mechanism like reconnection that produces these particles on the spot along the whole jet. And there have been some recent observations of 3C273 that argue that simple shock acceleration might not work in this context. Okay, so these are the questions that need to be addressed. Now let me briefly go through some of the existing models that have been proposed to explain acceleration of jets. So this is a very colorful picture. And what it means is the following. The first jet acceleration model that was proposed was a so-called twin exhaust model by Blanford and Reese in 1974. Since one of the authors is in the audience, which is actually true for most of the existing jet models, and it's always the same author. He has also been called upon yesterday many times to help out in times of need. So I will not try to go into too much detail here, because there are obviously experts who know much more than I do about this. But the underlying idea is that you have an accretion disk, and you release energy in the central region of the accretion disk. You produce basically clouds of relativistic particles above the accretion disk. And these particles then accelerate away buoyantly from the gravitational potential of the black hole. And as they do that, they accelerate along, say, a stratified atmosphere that sits above the disk. And if there is a stratified atmosphere all the way to large distances, you can actually accelerate this flow in this pressure gradient. It goes through a nozzle, sort of self-confined at a certain distance, and the collimation in this flow is provided by the external pressure. So the internal gas pressure of this flow is balanced by the external pressure from the stratified atmosphere. What we find is, or what you can find when you look at this, is that the typical acceleration of the flow happens in a self-similar fashion over a certain range, far away from this critical point here, and far away from the point where the jet becomes cold and is cold matter dominated. It follows a power law with external pressure to the minus 1 over 4, so minus 0.25. And so if the pressure follows a gradient of r, say r or z to the x, then the Lorentz vector of the jet will follow a radial appendence of minus x over 4. So, however, there are some problems with this model. And first of all, you do need this external collimation, and that requires large thermal pressure in the environment, which is not observed in X-ray observations. Furthermore, because you have a large number of relativistic particles which power your jet, you're susceptible to radiative losses, strong radiative losses in this inner region. So instead of accelerating your flow, you might radiate away most of the energy that you have available. Also, in a similar vein, because you have these relativistic particles that move at relativistic speeds, you're susceptible to radiation drag from external radiation, which slows your jet down. So there is a second model, which I alluded to before, which is the radiatively driven jet. And it's based on the principle that if you have a cloud of relativistic particles that, say, have a root mean square random Lorentz vector of a given value, then this cloud of particles will jump away from a radiation, from a non-isotropic radiation source that's at a certain location or distance away from it. So essentially, by inverse Compton scattering, this cloud will be accelerated away. And this is called the Compton rocket effect, and it was proposed by Odell. Oops. Was proposed by Odell. But it has since been proven to be very difficult to accelerate flows this way because, once again, you have radiative losses because you need a lot of relativistic particles to accelerate your flow. And furthermore, which is more stringent, actually, is that the terminal velocity of this flow is strongly limited by the solid angle that's subtended by the radiation source. Essentially, if this solid angle becomes larger than the Lorentz vector of the flow, then there is no more acceleration. So this brings me to the topic of MHD jets, which is sort of everybody's favorite model. So in this case, the jet is driven by a pointing flux. You tap essentially the rotational energy of the disk or the rotational energy of the black hole to do this. There's a sort of a nice circuit analogy from engineering, I guess. So you would have a battery sitting either in the spinning object, either the black hole or the disk. You have a load, which is a sort of dissipation at infinite distance, and in the middle you drive a current, and that's the jet. And you can actually work out that the numbers turn out to be. You can make a very simple. Model that describes the situation very well. I guess there's something missing here. Not that it really matters. This is only two or three letters. So this model works either with accretion disks or it works with black hole spin with variations, of course, in the details of the model. So, as I mentioned before, both models have the same author, and then various other people have extended this work to relativistic flows. So the acceleration mechanism works as follows. Close to the disk, you have a centrifugal acceleration mechanism. Essentially, if you have a magnetic field line anchored in the disk that's rotating around the central object, a blob of plasma sitting, or particle sitting on that field line, will be centrifugally accelerated away as long as the angle of this field line with respect to the disk is less than 60 degrees. And so this can actually launch a flow and accelerate it. And then secondly, you have essentially magnetic pressure gradients further out, which can accelerate the flow even beyond the fast Magnetic Intersonic point. And that's been called the magnetic nozzle. However, the efficiency of this process depends on the field geometry. So if the field lines open up relatively strongly, then you have a faster acceleration of the flow. The collimation in this case is provided either by hoop stresses. And so you can imagine having a field line that's wound like this around the jet. And this situation arises beyond the fast Magnetosonic point or beyond the light cylinder, where there's no more causal contact between the disk and the field line. So the field line can no longer co-rotate with the disk. And so it's wound up. And this, this winding process gives you this toroidal field structure. And stresses, tension in this toroidal field, actually try to squeeze the jet further in. And this has been proposed as the main mechanism for collimating jet. So essentially, magnetic tension in this scenario can collimate your jet. An alternative model, or an alternative way of collimating the jet, is simply by anchoring field lines in the disk and pushing them in by gravity. And so the foot point here will resist magnetic pressure, trying to drive the field lines further out. And so you can have a poloidal field that's anchored in the disk that's squeezed in by gravity in the disk that collimates the flow. So there is a problem, of course, with collimating flows using toroidal fields. And this problem is that there's an instability that tends to destroy field configurations like this. And this is called the kink instability. And what it does is essentially takes a straight jet with a toroidal field and it twists it up. It's like winding up a rubber band and then letting it go. It will try to make lots of loops. And so this is a strongly disruptive instability that will stop, that will essentially disrupt the flow. Secondly, it's hard to actually maintain a large-scale field in the accretion disk. And this has been shown by several groups. And the problem is that, first of all, you need to bring in large amounts of ordered magnetic fields from the ISM. And then you need to keep them stable in the disk. And there are instabilities like the interchange instability, which will try to drive the magnetic field outwards. Similarly, it's very difficult to produce large-scale ordered magnetic fields in the disk, because as we heard before, the magnetic field that's produced in the disk is actually highly turbulent. So this is the field that's produced by the magneto-rotational instability. And so it's unlikely, or it's at least difficult, to produce large amounts of ordered magnetic fields in the disk. There's another question which should be addressed, I guess, and that's the question of whether you can actually drive the flow outside of the magnetosonic radius, but I don't want to go into that. So finally, there's the Blandford-Znyayak mechanism, which is the extraction of energy from the spinning black hole. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail. Because this is a conference regarding the state of the art in the last 3 years, it should be mentioned that there have now been some simulations of this process, which are promising, at least. And so there needs to be more work to address this issue. But this is sort of the way to go. Within the next couple of years, I would expect that there will be major advances in the field of simulating magnetic fields around spinning black holes. So there have been some controversies in the past, a couple of years, I guess, about how efficient this mechanism can really be. And the questions that arise is, how much field can you actually bring into the region surrounding the black hole? How much field can enter the ergosphere or the horizon? And some of these questions have been addressed in talks regarding the accretion of material close in. And the second question, I guess, would be how much of the energy that you release by tapping the spin of the black hole actually goes back into the disk and not into a jet. Still, I would say this is the main paradigm of jet acceleration these days. However, I would like to propose an alternative model at this point, which is not based on the presence of large-scale ordered magnetic fields. Instead, we assume, this is work that was done in collaboration with Mitchell Beagleman in Colorado. Instead, we assume that the magnetic field that's fed into the jet is produced locally in the disk, and thus it is messy and strongly turbulent and tangled. The advantage of using magnetic fields, as I said before, as opposed to particles, is that you don't suffer radiation losses. However, in the case of tangled fields, you do no longer have the advantage of having a collimating agent like toroidal fields or a large-scale field that's anchored in the disk. And so you need some external collimation mechanism. And so the picture that we have, this is sort of a cartoon, is that you have an accretion disk, be it thick or thin, and somewhere close in where most of the energy is released, you produce a lot of magnetic field that's tangled. And so this tangled sort of wound up field is buoyantly rising in the disk, and it's hovering or being launched above the disk into some kind of an outflow. And so this outflow then accelerates, as in the case of a hydrodynamic model, accelerates in a stratified atmosphere. The atmosphere actually provides an external pressure. This atmosphere might be a wind that's launched from the accretion disk, a large-scale wind, or it might be just simply the atmosphere that the black hole is embedded in. And so this atmosphere provides the pressure confinement to the jet. What should be noted, however, and I'll go into that further, is that because you have small-scale tangled magnetic fields now, there are hoop stresses in this field. There's tension in the field that can actually reduce strongly the outward pressure of the field. And so it actually reduces the requirement of external collimation to the point where it's no longer inconsistent with the observed X-ray luminosity of thermal material in the surrounding medium. So let me briefly outline the model. It's a simple 1D model, so essentially all the equations are averaged across the jet. And in order to do that, we have to assume that the jet is narrow. So the opening angle of the jet must be smaller than the beaming angle, or 1 over gamma of the jet. Otherwise, you can no longer ignore the effects of curvature in the jet. Secondly, we assume a stationary model, so all time derivatives have been set to zero. And finally, as I mentioned before, there has to be some external stratification. So the pressure above the disk has to decline with height in order to provide collimation. So for the magnetic field, we assume essentially that it's chaotic on small scales, much smaller than the typical size scale of the jet, which would be the radius or the cross-section of the jet. Furthermore, for simplicity, we assume that that the jet is magnetically dominated. So the magnetic field pressure is much lower than the gas pressure. This is simply for a reason of computational ease. It's relatively straightforward to extend this whole picture to the case where you have gas pressure, but then the solutions are no longer quite as beautiful and simple. Assuming tangled fields essentially means that on average, each magnetic field component is zero, and cross terms also vanish. So if we average over a sufficiently large volume, then these terms should vanish. However, the magnetic field strength total does not vanish. So each of the components is randomly oriented, but is not vanishing. Assuming that the cross terms vanish essentially means that we set the Weissenberg constant to much smaller than 1. The Weissenberg constant is essentially the relaxation time of the magnetic field compared to the shear time, which tangles up the field. And people have recently looked at, Williams has looked at the case where this condition is not satisfied. But there needs to be more work regarding this this aspect, I guess. We assume, you can define a quantity that characterizes the anisotropy in the magnetic field. Each of the components of the magnetic field does not necessarily have to be equal to the others. You could have a situation, for example, where the magnetic field is strongly tangled, but it's mostly tangled perpendicular to the jet axis, and there is a very small component along the jet axis, so you would have a lot of loops essentially in the plane of the disk. And so then this parameter would be -1, for example. Alternatively, if you have most of the magnetic field aligned with the jet axis, this parameter would be 1. So you can adjust this parameter and see how the jet model reacts to that. Furthermore, we assume that the turbulence inside the jet retangles the field on dynamically short timescales. And so this essentially introduces an equation of state for the magnetic field components. And if you assume that in response to changes in the geometry of the jet, the field components are rearranged in a certain way, and you assume that this this rearrangement is independent of the actual width and velocity of the jet, which is reasonable, then these parameters should all be constant, and then that tells you roughly that the anisotropy of the jet is conserved. We can then write down the equations of motion, simply taking the relativistic stress-energy tensor, including magnetic field and cold particles, and then equating the equations of motion, you get the Bernoulli equation. You can average this across the jet, and we also get a sideways pressure balance equation, which determines the width of the jet. So looking at this then, you can go through the regular motions of calculating critical speeds and critical points, and then depending on what you assume for the anisotropy of the jet, this is essentially the parameter that we stick into this model. There is a critical point located at various distances from the central object. You can stick in gravity, which again alters the location of the critical points. And so far away from the critical point then, we find a self-similar solution, and the self-similar solution turns out to be the same as in the pure hydrodynamical case in the twin exhaust model. So I've plotted here the self-similar solution. Typical values for the pressure gradient, of course, depend on what you assume for the external medium. If you assume that there's a wind which has an r to the minus 2 profile, if it's an isothermal wind, it would have r to the minus 2 here. And so the Rance vector would scale as r to the minus 1 half. This is sort of the maximum you can achieve. So next, if you stick in cold matter, eventually the pointing flux will be balanced by the kinetic energy. And so most of the pointing flux will be converted into kinetic energy at large distances. And so the location of this terminal velocity, of course, only depends on the ratio of the inertial of the initial pointing flux to the initial rest mass density. And so you see that at larger distances, the material actually reaches an asymptotic state. I mentioned before, asymptotic pressure, anisotropic pressure, can help collimate the flow. It does not result in fast acceleration. This p to the minus 1/4 solution is actually valid for all anisotropies. You can see from this equation that actually producing a jet with varying degrees of different components of the field can actually reduce the required external pressure. If this is a very small quantity and these two are similar in order, for example, then you would have to have very little external pressure.
These are
b squares. Otherwise, this would be zero. We need zero pressure, but of course, that would be very unlikely given you had a very narrow jet. So in any case, there is a causality argument. In order for the flow to still be accelerated and to stay in causal contact with the environment, you have to satisfy the condition of being a narrow jet, which is very nice because that's what we stuck in as an initial assumption anyway. If this is not satisfied, then essentially the jet will be free, and it will produce shocks. And so you can translate this into a condition on the pressure gradient. And so the power law of pressure with distance from the black hole should be smaller than 2. So if this is there should be a minus here, sorry. So essentially, if you have a very steep, steeply stratified atmosphere where the pressure drops faster than r to the minus 2, then your jet will not be in causal contact. This is actually also true for the twin exhaust model. Because we have a simple prescription of the change of magnetic field, we can then add a simple prescription for dissipation of magnetic energy in the flow. And so we assumed for simplicity that it's DC heating in the sense that essentially as the jet geometry changes, you dissipate the energy that's fed into the magnetic field by turbulence, and according to some proportionality constant. And so essentially, this gives you a prescription of how the magnetic field energy is dissipated as the jet accelerates and expands. And so you see here, this is the curve. Sorry, I should have explained this. This is the Lorentz vector with distance to the black hole. This is the curve that includes dissipation, and this is the curve without dissipation. And from this plot, you see that the dissipation actually reduces the terminal, the asymptotic Lorentz factor. So the gas, the kinetic luminosity of the jet is reduced from the value it would have without dissipation, which is natural because some of the energy that you would have to accelerate your flow now goes into radiation. There is an interesting effect that's caused if you add this dissipation, and that is that the slope of this acceleration changes from this minus one quarter law. It can be shallower or it can be steeper. And so depending on the anisotropy in the field, dissipation can actually make your flow accelerate faster. And this is because essentially what it does is it creates a larger pressure gradient in the magnetic field, which then accelerates your flow in a much faster fashion. And so it can actually be much more efficient in accelerating flow if you include dissipation, which is an interesting result also found by Drenkhan and Spreut, which I guess we'll be able to discuss maybe in the next session. You find a similar behavior if you change the dissipation rate away from being DC heating, that's simply in response to change in geometry, proportional to, say, the alpha and crossing time of the jet. If you just assume that a constant fraction of magnetic field is simply dissipated away because you have magnetic field that's wound up on small scales. Similarly, it's very simple to add the effects of radiation drag to this analysis. Because you know how much energy is dissipated into relativistic particles, you can then calculate the maximal drag that's exerted, that can be exerted on a jet. And that sort of gives you a limit of how important radiation drag can be in this case. Simply by assuming that the radiative cooling that goes along with radiation drag is equal to the dissipation rate that heats the particles. And so the effect of this is to further decrease the acceleration rate, and it also further decreases the terminal Lorentz factor of the jet. However, it's not a dramatic effect unless you really have very strong dissipation rates. There are more diagnostics that you can apply to this. For example, you can look at the polarization that you expect from such a jet. You can look at the brightness that is produced in such a jet. I don't want to go into the details now. Instead, let me ask the question of what we can expect in the future, what should be done with this model also, and where generally I expect, or we should expect the most enhancements for jet theory to lie. So first of all, I mentioned that there is viscoelastic acceleration possible if you assume that the Weissenberg constant, say, is larger than one. There is an analogy to the viscoelastic case of, say, a spinning object that actually draws material towards its polar axis. This has been looked at by Williams. Natural extensions, of course, of a simple turbulent model would be to look at time-dependent flows or look at 2D or even 3D flows. Something I neglected, something that we didn't actually include, is the presence of particle pressure, be it turbulent or simple thermal particle pressure. You can show that depending on the amount of dissipation that that happens in the jet, after a relatively short amount of time, you would expect turbulent pressure and magnetic turbulent pressure to be in equilibrium. So this is an important effect that should be included. It's probably most reasonable to assume that in every jet, there is actually a combination of tangled fields and of highly ordered fields. If you look at images of jets, and if you look at the degree of polarization, there are places where it's very high, but there are places where it's not very high. Typically, it's very high in these knots, and if we interpret these knots as shocks, you can interpret the degree of polarization as being a result of compression of tangled magnetic fields. So typically, I guess, polarization measurements could be interpreted either way as being evidence of tangled or ordered magnetic fields. Of course, it would be interesting to look at models that include both effects. However, I don't see how that could be done except in a numerical context right now. Finally, I mentioned before that it's now possible to look at 3D general relativistic MHD with numerical codes. They're now running, and I would expect that in the near future, models of relativistic jets being either driven by ordered magnetic fields, or maybe if we can convince someone to run this on their code, by tangled magnetic fields. So let me put up my conclusions. The phenomenon of jet production is most likely an MHD phenomenon. The Blanford-Zinyak effect is the most elegant solution. Maybe if we have some more detailed simulations, we will be able to conclude that it might be the most realistic. Large-scale ordered fields have some problems. They're hard to maintain in a disk, and there are instabilities that act on these fields. And tangled fields might be an alternative way of launching some of these flows from accretion disks, and simulations would be a promising way to continue in this direction. Thanks. No, not yet. I mean, this would be, of course, an important effect. However, if the jet expands beyond a certain point, then conservation of angular momentum would simply mean that it slows down. Since this is a 1D model, we did not include actual effects of differential rotation inside the jet. For the first three pictures I show you. Well, I mean, the pictures of jets I showed you are actually for the large scale emission from jets, and so at that point, the actual acceleration will have already happened. The acceleration stage will be very close into the core, which was not included in those pictures. Any of these models would presumably be able to reproduce a large scale outflow. The features in those pictures are actually produced by interaction, either with the environment or internally to the flow. That's possible. I guess we assume that the magnetic field is completely turbulent. I guess that would then add an extra term of stress into your equations. That would probably increase the amount of collimation, I would assume. So it would only help, I guess.
Could you comment some more on this viscoelastic idea that you mentioned?
Right.
So spinning objects sometimes wrong?
Well, if you have a spinning, it depends on the amount of viscosity. If you say you have an egg that's very viscous, and you embed a spinning sphere inside that this very viscous fluid, then the effect of it will actually be to draw material from the equatorial plane and squeeze it up to the rotation axis. So this is sort of the opposite that of what you would expect the centrifugal forces to do.
Well, this is sort of an echo.
I wouldn't know.
If you spin water in a bowl, for example, and you look at the flow pattern near the bottom of the bowl, where the viscous bounding layer is, you get a concentration.
Yeah, this is, yeah, might be. Yeah, it's probably similar.
Could you said a bit more about the external pollination, the pressure that's required in the tank and field model. What provides that pressure and on what scale?
So the simplest assumption, I guess, would be that if you have an external wind that's launched from the accretion disk that's external to, say, a jet like this. I mean, this is a 1D model, of course. You would really expect that there to be a stratification also in the radial direction. And so it might really be that you have a core of fast material that's embedded in a sheath of slower material that's moving outward. In order for reasonable amounts of acceleration to be obtained, you would have to assume that the pressure falls off somewhere between R to the minus 1 and R to the minus 2. The amount of pressure, I guess, you would need depends on the ratio of the radial to the phi component of the magnetic field, on average.
Do you think you can get enough gas pressure to affect the pollination for powerful jets?
I would assume that should be possible. It requires certain assumptions about the magnetic field. In a sense, it has to have very little magnetic field component along the jet. So the parallel component of the magnetic field has to be relatively small. So most of the magnetic field should be in loops that are perpendicular to the jet axis. Yes, they're small scale currents, I guess, because the field reverses on very short time scales. No. Yeah, I'm sure this would be very relevant. I'm sure this would be very relevant. I mean, if we have enough time for this.
Look at problems like this, both with the orderly toroidal confinement or with your partial magnetic confinement with your turbulent fields. You know, the way you've done the model, you can reduce the amount of external pressure you need because you have a certain amount of work notation, minus BR squared, cancel them all. If I write down the virial theorem for this system, it says magnetic pressures always cause expansion. If you actually look at what happens in a pinched confinement, in fact, I don't know if anybody in this room, how many people in this room have ever gone to some of the pinch experiments that are done when you squash a plasma this way. When this happens, the coils that are supporting the magnetic field react. You know, the action-reaction has not been done away with. And your confinement is actually dependent upon the fact that in spite of the fact you think you're holding things in with these hoops of magnetic field, those hoops of magnetic field are doing work on the surroundings. So you need either pressure or inertia out there to hold them in. And saying that I've improved my confinement by adding this hoop stress, you have not done away with the need of all of these models for an external medium to hold the thing there. Otherwise, you know, if you take a light fluid like this, you basically have a gamma equals 4/3 gas. If you take that away, it'll blow itself apart at the relativistic sound speed.
Sure. I mean, as I said, you do need external medium to collimate it. I would argue that the amount of pressure is reduced, but I guess we can discuss that.
Either pressure or inertia.
Well, right. Well, again, this is a question of the magnetic field configuration. If you can manage to put most of your field into small loops, then you could reduce the amount of pressure that you need by the ratio of the. You disagree? Okay.
Far, you know, above this jet, way far up above. How does the disk ever know about it?
Once you have a sign, when you can transmit those stresses from the disk.
In fact, that happens also for the orderly field once you go through the unbanked surface. In this case, what happens is that you, I think, you use a smaller, it's a total, same total force has to be applied, but you have, magnetic field gives you an extra lever arm, so you can apply a smaller pressure over a larger surface.
Well, I don't see, yeah.
So you can actually have a difference in pressure, but the total force is the same.
Maybe you can do away with some of the pressure, but you'll need inertia of cold gas out there.
Sure.